Well, good morning, everyone, and thank you for coming. The topic for my presentation, which is with Dr. Amod Thakur, who's also with us this morning, is a bit of an outlier, but it wasn't clear where this would best fit in the program, so we're very happy to be associated with plant and water sensing, since we think the plants are kind of super sensors, and we're going to discuss ways in which by managing the growing environment for the crop, it can be more productive, more efficient with its water, and also with a focus on what it can do for climate resilience, this being a great subject for us to focus on. There's been controversy over the system of rice intensification developed in Madagascar because of some very high reported outlying yields, even over 20 tons per hectare, which makes some people freak out. Since at one point Erie calculated the biological maximum was 18 tons per hectare. You couldn't produce more than that. But in fact, we've seen plants surpassing that when given the proper environment above ground and below ground. And these methods and these ideas have been gaining momentum around the world. We have had very measurable improvements in plant phenotype and substantial increases, not just in outlying, but actually in average yields, reported from over 50 countries around the world when these methods are used, and not even necessarily used 100%, but approximated. I want to start just mentioning that we don't call this a technology, but rather a methodology, and it's a matter of degree. It isn't either you do it or you don't, but to what extent do you take advantage of the insights for raising crop productivity and benefit from that? And as I say, we emphasize this as a set of ideas rather than a technology. This is a map just showing how this has spread since the first validations less than 20 years ago in India and Indonesia and in China. Validation, we say, is demonstrated better, more robust phenotypes from a given genotype. I hope you're all familiar with that. Most of you are water specialists, which I was for many years as a social scientist. I want to emphasize that every plant, every organism starts as a genotype, a certain genetic potential. What can be done to get that potential expressed to the maximum? Most of the attention is focused on yield effects of SRI, but we've become more and more interested in how these methods can help farmers adapt to, as well as buffer the adverse stresses of climate change, and at the same time reduce the emissions of greenhouse gases from the rice paddies, which are one of the major sources of methane, as you know, but could be a source of nitrous oxide if drained. Achieving these three effects qualifies innovation as climate-smart agriculture. You raise production. If you enable the crops to adapt to the forces, the biotic and abiotic stress of climate change, and if you can also help mitigate global warming in the process. Those are the three criteria which FAO has introduced. We haven't been able to do as thorough data collection on this because we haven't had resources for this, but in 2013 we got from China, India, Indonesia, Vietnam, and Cambodia what we understood to be very good and, for that matter, conservative data. These are countries where there's government support and also countries where 2/3 of the world's rice is produced, so we're getting a major chunk of that. We found at least 3.5 million farmers using these methods on about 9.5 million hectares of land, and we calculated that the average yield with this management was 6.22 tons per hectare versus 4.56 in the comparison yields for these countries. This is a 40% increase in yield with less water, less seeds, and less of other inputs. Some will say there's more labor initially, which is true, but also we often find, at least in Asia, that these methodologies lower your labor inputs as well. The average increase in yield was 1.66 tons per hectare on this 3.5 million hectares. That's 5.75 million tons of additional rice simply by using available resources differently and better. We've calculated farm gate price, which is $150 per ton of rice, that this would mean $862 million of benefit the farmers got with their existing resources by using them differently. If you consider that the cost of production is lowered when you don't have less water, less fertilizer, less seed, in India, they calculate $28 per ton lower cost of production with these methods. And if you without even considering the value of the water saved or the value of reduced greenhouse gas emissions, it's over $1 billion in benefit, which farmers were able to get just in these five countries. If you figured a more realistic price, a farm gate price of $300 per ton, that was over $2 billion. It's a huge impact, which is available to farmers by using their resources differently. The system of rice intensification involves certain changes in the management of plants, soil, water, and nutrients. We start with wider spacing of plants. We cut the plant population by about 80 to 90%. Fewer plants will give you more yield if you do some other beneficial things with it. We start with very young seedlings, less than 15 days, preferably 8, 10, 12 days, because we have more growth potential and they have more tillering, more vigorous root growth. We have mostly aerobic soil conditions, using water very sparingly, providing just the minimum that the plant needs, the plant plus the soil biota need. We recommend active soil aeration, so to control the weeds, use the mechanical weeder, which churns up the top few centimeters, of soil, so both the roots and the microbes have more aeration. And we enhance soil organic matter as much as possible to get better soil structure and functioning for better root growth and then more abundant, diverse, and active soil biota. These ideas started originally with irrigated rice in Madagascar, but they've been adapted and transplanted, adapted for direct seeding and also for upland unirrigated cultivation. These ideas are very flexible, as I'll close my presentation showing you. And the two purposes of these changes in management are A, to grow bigger, deeper, longer-lived root systems, and B, to have more abundant, biodiverse, and active soil organisms. These are sort of the foundations. This is some pictures we were sent by the farmers from Indonesia and Liberia, in this case, show you the difference in phenotype that you can get from a given genotype by spacing, less crowding, well, no flooding, no suffocation of the roots, et cetera, et cetera. These are some of the better contrasts we've had. On the other hand, they show you what potential is available in the rice genome if we give it the optimum growing conditions. Come to water, we did a meta-analysis published in Taiwan Water Conservancy 2013, where grad students of mine at Cornell searched the literature for all things that looked at water use, water productivity. They found 29 studies where we had enough data that we could do very detailed analysis. This is across 8 countries, 251 comparison trials. The standard water use per hectare was 15 million liters per hectare, and the SRI cut that to 12 with higher yield. This is a 22% reduction in total water use per hectare and a 35% reduction in irrigation water use per hectare. The water use efficiency was increased 52% in total terms and 78% in terms of irrigation. These figures are actually much higher if you had farmer yields. These are on-station trials, which for some reason almost always give us lower yields of these methods than on farmers' fields. That's unusual because usually it's the other way around. Farmers can't replicate research results. Often I find researchers don't replicate farmers' results. But this gives you an overview of the kind of water saving which can be achieved with these changes in management. Some phenotypic evidence I found very impressive, and this is work that Amo did at the Indian Institute of Water Management in Bhubaneswar, where he looked at the water use efficiency within plants as a ratio of photosynthesis to transpiration. And he found that in SRI plants, for each millimole of water lost by transpiration, the plants fixed 3.6 micromoles of CO2 versus 1.6 for conventionally grown plants with less good root systems, less good leaf area index, all kinds of other factors that go into this efficiency of the plant. This kind of efficiency at the plant level is going to be more and more important as we deal with climate change. This is a picture we were telling Susan Huihui about beforehand. This is a plant given to myself and my wife in Indonesia about 6 years ago. This is a plant grown from one seed, 223 tillers on it. I don't know how many of you work on rice. U.S., we don't do so much rice, more wheat, it's true. But, you know, 15, 20, 30, 40 tillers from one plant, that's good. This is 223. I've held it in my hands and took this picture. But look at also that root system, because roots and tillers both come from the same tissue, and so they're coordinated. This is a picture which helped me, first of all, understand what was going on from Cuba. This farmer, Luis Romero, whom I've visited, is holding two plants, same variety, planted in the same nursery at the same time, but the one on the right was taken out when it was only 8 days old and transplanted wide spacing, organic matter, soil aeration, and he was going to transplant the one on the left at 52 days, which is their usual time in Cuba. And so happened our friend Dr. Rena Perez was visiting him, had her camera in her car, got it, and so you can see the difference in the root growth, and also then above ground it's 43 versus 5 tillers from the same genotype. Now people often doubt pictures these days because of photoshopping, so next year she took a video camera out every week, and this is on the web. If you want, I can give you a website. You watch this week by week by week unfolding of genetic potential to get this large kind of plant on the right versus the smaller one on the left. These are pictures sent to me by scientists in Iran and Iraq, where they were impressed to see the difference in the root growth in their rice plants, same variety, but different management practices. The one from Iran on the left, you see the difference in coloration. The roots of the right-hand plant there are dying from hypoxia because continuous flooding cuts off the oxygen supply to the plant. But this is also one of my favorite pictures sent by researchers at the Iraqi rice research station near Najaf. And here they are testing different varieties' response to different management measures. They weren't able to do the water control difference very much because the plots are next to each other. It's hard to control the levels there. But you see the difference. The left-hand ones are grown from young seedlings, wide spacing, reduced plant population, more organic matter, soil aeration. And you see how the plant responds to that. The soil biota effect is much harder to get a hold of. You can see roots, you can see tillers, you count them, you count grains or panicle. This is a summary of research from Tamil Nadu Agricultural University in India, also ICRISAT, the International Center for Research in Semi-Arid Tropics, one of the CGIAR centers, and from IPB, the Indonesian Agricultural University in Bogor, looking at bacteria, diazotrophs, specifically phosphorus-solubilizing microbes, and some of the enzymes that reflect biological activity in the root zones. And we found this consistent difference, not always the same, because in biology, you get huge variation. Sometimes even hour to hour, morning to afternoon, certainly season to season. But these give you an idea that the pattern we see is that when you have more organic matter in the soil, better soil aeration, bigger roots and more root exudation, the microbes respond. This is research that first got me turned on to the idea of not just roots or organisms in the rhizosphere, but also endophytes, organisms living inside the plant's tissues and organs. This is done with replicated trials for baccalaureate thesis in 2001 already. And in the first case, we're looking at clay soils and loam soils. If you use farmer methods with no soil amendments, you got 1.8 ton yield, which is about the national average in Madagascar. If you just use the methods with no soil amendments, you went up to three times. If you added NPK, you got still another 50% increase in yield. But if you use compost, another 16% on top of that. And so that was what first started informing me what was going on. When they used loam soil, SRI methods with no soil amendments were not that much to increase, but if you added compost, again, you got a very healthy response. What's interesting is that second column, Azospirillum is the nitrogen-fixing bacteria. You may know about that. 65,000 per milligram, 1.1 million. If you put on NPK, you reduce those microbes 450,000. But if you add a compost, it jumps up again. And here you see the effect, what the compost does to microbial populations, which have a positive effect on yield. So anyway, that got us interested. This is research from Egypt, published in the Australian Journal of Plant Physiology, looking at the effect of microbes on root growth. And here you see increase in rootlets per plant, root length, surface area, root biovolume, significant differences with two different varieties when they inoculate with Rhizobium leguminosarum. So the roots and the microorganisms are things we don't see because we don't look below the surface. but we're finding still, okay? So I'll move along. This research from China showing the difference in the phenotype of same variety in the different organs, how they respond to this during the from between heading and maturation. Evidence of climate resistance we're now getting more systematically, drought resistance, resistance to lodging, resistance to pests and diseases, tolerance of cold temperatures. This is a Sri Lankan picture of the same varieties, same soil, but the water supply stopped 3 weeks earlier. And you see how having the large deep root system affects that. On-farm evidence, it's an EME study in Sri Lanka, finding that in a drought stress year, 75 days of drought, 80% of the tillers of SRI plants formed panicles, only 70% others. Even though there were 10 times more plants per square meter, the number of panicle-bearing tillers was actually greater in the SRI plots, et cetera, et cetera. This is evidence from Sichuan, China at the macro scale, provincial-wide scale. 2006 and 2010 were drought years in Sichuan. And those are the years when, in fact, the advantage of SRI management over conventional increased substantially. Weather resistance, this is work that was done at the India Ag Research Institute, finding with wheat, with the same kind of managed practices, that the normal season advantage of SWI, wheat intensification, over their own best recommendations was 30% in a climate-stressed year. The next year, it just happened to be a climate-stressed year, a 46% increase. So we find that having those root systems and interactive with microbes makes a huge difference. This is from Vietnam after a storm has passed over the fields, and you see the difference in the plants and the fields behind them. On the right is conventional management, blown over, lodged. On the left, hardly a plant is affected by that. This is a picture from a GTZ and EFAD publication showing the difference in terms of resistance to storm damage. This is, I won't go into this, this is from Hebei province, showing again with very detailed measurements on breaking resistance, bending moment, interval length, as to why the SRI phenotypes manage better than the others. Well, this one summarized a lot. This shows you resistance of both lodging and to pest damage. These are fields where it's exposed to brown plant hopper, one of the worst pests for rice crops in Asia. And this is conventional modern variety fertilizer. That's traditional variety and organic management, and you see how it resisted. He got almost nothing. The woman who did the SRI methods there, who gave me the picture, I know the background, 8-ton yields with traditional variety with storm stress and microbes. Anyway, we're also finding, I won't go into this, that you have enough reduction in methane and no compensating offsets of nitrous oxide, which would undermine the effect that we get 20-25% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions from rice paddies by using these methods. That's Korean research. And then we're finding that these same ideas can be used for many other crops: wheat, sugar cane, finger millet, sorghum, teff. Some of you may know teff in Ethiopia. If you've been to an Ethiopian restaurant, you know what teff is good for. Maize, and then all kinds of miscellaneous crops in India, Ethiopia, Nigeria, Sierra Leone. This is a picture from Bihar, state of India, showing wheat crops, same variety, planted at the same time. The accelerated growth gives you already a very abundant wheat response there. This is a picture from finger millet. On the right, you have a traditional variety, traditional methods. In the middle is improved variety with traditional methods. You see what genes can do, positive. But if you use SRI methods with improved variety, you see the phenotype on the left. Then the last one here is from Ethiopia. Normally you get about 1-ton yield with, you know, broadcasted teff. If you start by transplanting small seedlings, 20 by 20 spacing, starting with that little tiny seed, it's a mustard-sized seed, you get 3 to 5 tons per hectare. With micronutrients, 6, 7, 8 tons yield. That's just a whole different phenotype when you plant change a plant. So SRI is a way of combining change in plant management, soil management, water management, and then nutrient management with the effect of growing better root systems and more active communities. This closing picture is from Bihar, where This is a field being harvested where the yield was measured by the technicians as 23.2 tons per hectare, which was a new world record. Again, I wasn't there, but I do. This is provided me by the Director of Rice Development in Bihar, and you can just look at those plants and how productive they are when given. So the thing is, and water management is part of it, but not the only thing. We do just water management, we're missing opportunities. That's why alternate wetting and drying is part of our methodology, but it's not all there is. If you do AWD, you don't lose yield and you save water. It's more efficient. That's good. But farmers have no incentive just to save water for someone else's benefit. If by reducing their water, they also get more productivity, more income, they're going to be way ahead. Well, I could talk about this for hours, maybe even days. I won't. Thank you for the time. I'd be glad to answer any questions. The chair can decide how to handle this. Yes, when there is.
You've shown strikingly difference in translation efficiency. So many molecules of CO2 things.
Right, mm-hmm.
Or this many molecules of water.
Mm-hmm.
What instrument is used for.
Amos here can answer how that was done.
We always believe that water is efficient, you know, increase so drastically, I'm not sure from these people.
I didn't mention that we find that the crop cycle. From a water management perspective, the fact that our growing season is shortened by 5 to 10, even 15 days with higher yield, you're getting more product per day as well as per unit of water.
I can understand the total water use efficiency, that means the total amount of water used and total amount of yield you get. That's okay. But when you come to translation, it's the trade-off. How much time you keep the tomato open, how much water you use for taking the
I love to have more research on just that kind of physiological, morphological question. What we're doing is reporting what we're seeing and measuring. The general explanation I'd offer is that the plant's metabolism is more, you know, accelerated. It matures in, you know, 5, 10, 15 days less with more yield. And so I think that the control over the stomata and everything is also upregulated to make this possible. Okay, way back.
Interesting. My question is, have you done similar research here in the United States?
In the U.S.
Yeah. And the second question would be, you know, looking at just, you know, the picture we can't tell, you know, how productive, you know, the approach, especially, I could say, you know, both above and below ground. So we see a massive, you know, root system there. And have you had a chance to look at the nitrogen use efficiency comparing those two
with those? We have over 1,000 published journal articles from around the world over the last 15 years, including things like nitrogen use efficiency. Amod's published an article in Plant and Soil on nitrogen efficiency. We don't understand it fully yet, but we're getting a pretty good handle on it. In terms of U.S., we've tried very hard to get U.S. growers interested in this. Maybe there's a certain amount of complacency or a sense that they know everything already, almost everything. So we find much more receptivity in some of the developing countries where they have very urgent needs and resource limitations. We have had farmers in Louisiana, in New York, New Jersey, Maryland, who tried this on a very experimental basis, and they're seeing an effect. But a lot depends upon the soil microbes, is whether you've got sort of an established population to hype and accelerate. And especially if you use your or growing your crops with high chemical inputs, fertilizers and biocides of all sorts, this has a suppressing effect upon this microbial communities, and it can take a while to restore their vigor and their diversity. So we often don't expect to see that much if there's been a lot of agrochemical use before these methods are used. If you're a poor farmer who hasn't used anything, you can see a very quick response to these methods. We're not against use of chemical fertilizer, by the way. The yields up here were done with about 40 kg of nitrogen and a little bit of phosphorus and so on, but mostly it was organic fertilization. And so ultimate integrated nutrient management will give you the very highest yields. Whether that's the most profitable depends upon the economics of your input costs and how much labor you have to develop organic fertilization. But again, I'm presenting this not that we know everything yet already. This is a work in progress, but the progress in the last 20 years or so. But we think there are a lot of potentials, and particularly where water saving becomes an issue. Growing roots is the first thing. I mean, I tell farmers when I'm out, don't grow plants, grow roots. And if you grow good roots, the plants will take care of themselves, by and large. So I think we have much more emphasis on soil structure functioning, you know, organic supplies, so the plant will be able and willing to go to greater depths. Flooding means in rice you only have roots most in the top 10 or 20 centimeters. We go down 30, 40, 50 centimeters in the soil, tap nutrient sources that are otherwise unavailable to the plant. Especially if you get a pan with your flooding, you know, then you're not going to be able to tap the full potentials of the soil system. So.
Well, with that, let's thank Norman again.
Thank you.